Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive and deadly myths that are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission on this program is to understand what is occurring behind the headlines while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His is the lone credible voice in an exceedingly disingenuous world. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. Well, there are a lot of things worth talking about today, and somehow this has become old news. It ought not have been. It's like so many of the events in our past with WikiLeaks, for example, where we were given access to the inner workings of our government and found it to be rotten to the core, and people just yawned. Well, so has been the case with the acknowledgement and proof that the United States has decided that its own citizens are the enemy and decided that it has the right to violate its constitution and to spy on them. So we're going to today go over a USA Today report. This is a bit where they contacted three individuals who over the past 5 or 6 years had made it their mission to expose the very thing that Snowden exposed. The difference was that these three individuals were all more senior CSA and NSA operatives. The difference is that they initially, when they came to know that what they were doing was wrong, they went to their supervisors and found absolutely no support. Their supervisors, who were senior officers in the NSA and CSA, saw nothing wrong with violating the U.S. Constitution and making the U.S. citizen the enemy. The difference between these three individuals and Snowden is that these three individuals actually wrote the code that created the programs known as PRISM and the mechanisms of collecting information on our use of our telephones. The difference between these guys and Snowden is that they were senior enough and had been in the U.S. government employed long enough that they had the wherewithal to go to the senior NSA and CIA officials and met with them to complain and said that what we are doing is in direct violation of the oath of the Constitution that we have promised to serve. They found the senior administrators of the FBI and NSA unwilling to do the right thing. The difference between these three men and Snowden is that these three individuals also went to Congress. They met with senators and congressmen and told them what was happening so that members of Congress, particularly in the intelligence subcommittees, have no excuse. They were warned 5 years in advance of Snowden's release that the U.S. government was in direct violation of its constitution and that had determined that the average American was worth spying upon because that means that the average American had become the enemy of the U.S. government. They found absolutely no rational, moral compulsion to do the right thing by any congressman or senator. So these three men, unable to have access to the actual documents that as a lowly administrator of a database Snowden had, talked to the media. And the media did not believe them. And they were persecuted by the U.S. government. As whistleblowers, the U.S. government decided to harass them, and the media ignored them. The only difference with Snowden is that he, as a database administrator, was able to deliver the proof that what these men had been saying over the years was true. So here is their story. When a national security agency contractor revealed top secret details this month on a government collection of American phone numbers and internet records. One group of intelligence veterans breathed a sigh of relief. Thomas Drake, William Binney, and J. Kirk Wiebe, belonging to a select fraternity, the NSA officials, who paved the way. For years, the three whistleblowers had told anyone who would listen that the NSA collects huge swaths of communications data from U.S. citizens. They had spent decades in the top ranks of the agency, designing and managing the very data collection systems they say had been turned against Americans. When they became convinced that fundamental constitutional rights were being violated, they complained, first to their superiors, then to federal investigators, to congressional oversight committees, and finally to the news media. To the intelligence community, the trio are villains who compromised what the government classifies as some of its most secret, crucial, and successful initiatives. Imagine that now. If that's true, to the intelligence community, spying on Americans, turning their spying capability onto ordinary Americans, violating the U.S. Constitution's Fourth Amendment, is amongst their most successful initiatives. These three men have been investigated as criminals and have been forced to give up their careers, their reputations, and the friendships they built over a lifetime. That's the way the U.S. government plays. It's a nasty, nasty enterprise. Today, they feel somewhat vindicated. They say the documents leaked by Snowden, the 29-year-old, I think he's actually a 30-year-old, former NSA contractor, who worked as a systems administrator, proves their claims of sweeping government surveillance of millions of Americans not suspected of any wrongdoing. They say that those revelations only hint at the program's reach. Now, that's the key aspect here. The surveillance programs are targeted against Americans who are not suspected of any wrongdoing, which makes it a gross violation of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution of unreasonable search and seizure. On Friday, USA Today brought Drake, Binney, and Wiebe together for the first time since the story broke to discuss the NSA revelations. With their lawyer, Jessalyn Radek, the Government Accountability Project, she is of the Government Accountability Project, they weighed their implications and their repercussions. They disputed the administration's claim that the impact of the disclosures on national security and President Obama's argument that Congress and the courts are providing effective oversights was nonsense. And they have warnings for Snowden on what he should expect. First question. Did Edward Snowden do the right thing in going public? William Binney. We tried to stay for the better part of 7 years inside of the government, trying to get the government to recognize the unconstitutional and illegal activity that they were doing, and to get the government to openly admit and to devise certain ways that it could be constitutionally and legally acceptable to achieve the means they were after. So Bill Binney saying, we tried for 7 years inside the government to first get the government to acknowledge that what they were doing was unconstitutional, therefore illegal at the highest possible level, and to say there is a better way, a legal way, to accomplish the goals you're after. And that's just failed, totally, because no one in Congress, we couldn't get anyone in the courts, and certainly not the Department of Justice and Inspector General's office, to pay any attention to any of this. And all of the efforts we made just produced no change whatsoever. All it did was continue to get worse and to expand. So the courts, federal courts in particular, that are sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution, didn't care that the U.S. Constitution was being violated. Now, the Supreme Court particularly doesn't rule on the U.S. Constitution anymore. They rule on their own political agenda and issues that intersect the U.S. Constitution are very seldom heard by them. Question. So did Snowden do the right thing? Benny. Yes, he did. Question. You three wouldn't criticize him for going public from the start. Kirk Wiebe. Correct. We would not criticize him for going public. He did the right thing. Benny. In fact, I think he saw and read about our experience and what we endured. And that was part of his decision making. He knew that we had failed when attempting to encourage accountability from inside. Wiebe, I agree. Radek, the attorney. Not only did they go through multiple and all of the proper internal challenges or channels, but they failed. But more than that, it was turned against them. The Inspector General was one of those who gave their names to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution under the Espionage Act. In other words, these three guys did the right thing. They said what the NSA doing is unconstitutional. They went to the Justice Department to have what the government was doing investigated so that the government would not continue to violate its own constitution. And what happened? The Justice Department turned these three guys in and wanted them prosecuted for espionage. It's the way the government is. It's rotten to the core. And they were all targets of federal criminal investigations. They ended up being prosecuted. And it was for blowing the whistle on the government. If you are patriotic, there's something deficient in your ability to think, to be moral. There's a question being debated whether Snowden is a hero or a traitor. Benny, certainly he performed a very valuable public service to begin with by exposing these programs and by making the government in a sense of a publicly accountable, at least in the sense of making the government publicly accountable. But now he is starting to talk about things that, like the government hacking into China and all that sort of thing, and he's going a little too far. I don't think he had access to that program. But somebody talked to him about it, so he has talking about it. And from what I've read anyway, he said that someone, a reliable source, told him that the U.S. government is hacking into all different countries around the world. That's not a public service. And now he is going a little beyond public service. You know, Mr. Benny, I beg to differ with you. Well, the first release was absolutely a public service. The public yawned. Now the only way to get accountability is pressure from other countries. We'll return in a moment. There was an interesting comment here by Benny as he shows a side that I do not think is appropriate. And even though I applaud him for being a whistleblower, I disagree here. He said that Snowden transitioned from being a whistleblower and doing a public service to being a traitor when he acknowledged that the United States is spying on the citizens of many nations. The reality is, and I know this is considered blasphemy to American patriots, but the United States doesn't have any enemy worth having a military to prevent taking away Americans' freedom. This notion that our military protects our freedom is absolute nonsense. It has been nonsense for a very long time, maybe forever. Maybe we'll do another program on the history of America's wars to demonstrate that America has really never deployed its military for the purposes of American freedom. And that all America ever has to do is honor the Second Amendment and allow Americans to keep and bear arms without restriction. And you could do away with the military entirely, and there'd be no way for any country at any time to invade the nation. But the reality is there is no nation on earth, not the Russians, not the Chinese, who have the inclination to invade and occupy America, nor the ability to invade and occupy America. And if you were to give those nations the next 20 years, should they magically come up with an inclination to invade and occupy America, they couldn't in 20 years come up with the wherewithal to do so. They don't have it, and there is no chance that they're going to develop it. It is a complete myth that there is a value in spying on those countries to know what their intentions are And it's a complete myth to say that our U.S. military and the $650 to $750 billion that we squander on it, in addition to the money we squander on counterproductive wars, keeps us safe. Does not. It is absolutely stupid. And what America does when it spies on citizens from other countries is it infuriates them. I mean, for the most part, America is despised in Central and South America. For the most part, we're despised in Europe. You know, there's a reason beyond just Islam that America is despised in the Islamic world. Our intervention in other countries through NSA and CIA spying and CIA malfeasance generates enemies. And if you expose programs that have no value whatsoever to American security, that are in fact making enemies out of other nations and the people of other nations, then you're doing a service for Americans. He's not being a traitor here. What's wrong here, what is the traitor, is our own inability to process this information rationally. Americans get so caught up in patriotism and politics and their religion and all these kind of things meshed together, and they become incapable of recognizing what's really reliable, what's really appropriate, what is unreliable, and what is inappropriate. Our snooping, our NSA, CIA, NGIC, and military intelligence are all counterproductive. They're making people mad at us. They're doing the wrong things. They're acting illegally. And the results of their actions are caustic to Americans. And there is no enemy that America is defending us from, that our military is defending us from. Now, do people around the world have an enemy in Islam? Absolutely. But you can't defeat that enemy by speaking glowingly of the religion, of transferring hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons to nations that embrace the religion, and lying about the religion. And you can't beat a religious foe with bullets and bombs. Every time you send a drone to kill a fundamentalist Muslim, you manufacture 100 for every one you kill. There is no purpose whatsoever that is beneficial today for the CIA and NSA or even the U.S. military. If we were to scrap them all, we would save $1 trillion and an enormous amount of embarrassment, and at least have a chance of solving our deficit. We'll return with this interview. We'll hear a statement from Thomas Drake and then the attorney Raddick before we move on to the next question posed by USA Today as they presented a roundtable discussion with three individuals from the NSA working on this project who had come before Snowden. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Question asked by USA Today to the threesome of individuals who went before Snowden and told everyone who would listen, their supervisors, the head of the NSA and CIA, the Judicial Justice Department of the United States, as well as congressmen and senators, that the United States government was violating its own constitution. And they were asked the question, was Snowden a hero or a traitor? Thomas Drake answered, "He's an American who has been exposed to some incredible information regarding the deepest secrets of the United States government. And we are seeing the initial outlines and contours of a very systematic, very broad, and Leviathan surveillance state. And much of it is in violation of the fundamental basis of our country. In fact, the very reason we had our own American Revolution. And the Fourth Amendment, for all intents and purposes, was revoked after 9/11. He is, by all definitions, a classic whistleblower. And by all definitions, he exposed information in the public interest. We now finally have the debate that we never had following 9/11. Wow. Stunning statement. We'll go on with the next question in a moment, but we have Nick having called in from Wisconsin. Nick's called the program many times in the past relative to a nephew, I believe, could even be a sister, but a family member who married a Muslim and searching to find information on Islam is what originally drew him to us. And since that time, Nick's called in many times with interesting insights and great questions. Nick, welcome back to the program. I haven't heard from you for a while.
Good morning. When you point out those, when you quote what's written in Tabari, and and what I hear back from the Muslim defenders is that what I quote is not true, and that there is no known. I mean, there. Those who write this on social network or on the sites like Prophet of Doom do not have links to Arabian version of those sayings. And so that's where my question is.
All right.
Where are those links?
Okay. All right. What they're in essence saying is that they cannot refute the material. They can't. There is no answer for the information, that the evidence that is found in Tabari and Ishaq. Ishaq wrote the neither Tabari nor Ishaq wrote the history or the biography. They're both collections of hadith, just put in chronological order. So all they're doing is compiling and collecting the evidence that is available to them. They're saying that since they don't have the ability to refute any of it, they're just going to say it's untrue, and then they're going to try to ignorantly hope that they can, with a just kind of a wave of their hand, make it all go away. And so what they typically do is they say, well, you're quoting them in English, and you know, in Arabic it's different. Or they say that that Islam is based solely on the Quran and not on the Hadith collections. This person is trying to say that you don't have links to the Arabian version. Okay, here's the truth. The Quran and Hadith were both came from exactly the same person, Muhammad. The Quran and Hadith were maintained by the same people, which was Muhammad's companions. Both the Quran and the Hadith were maintained in the same way by these same people for over 100 years before they were written down. There is absolutely no difference in the substance of the Quran and the substance of the Hadith. They are from the same person, about the same event, transmitted in exactly the same way. The Tabari's Tariq, which is the history of Islam's formation, and Ishaq's Sirah, which is the biography of Muhammad, are collections of hadith. That's all they are, put in chronological order. And since there is absolutely no difference between the source of those hadith, the subject of those hadith, the person who made the hadith and Quran statements, and the way that they were, the people who passed them on and the means that they passed them on for 100 years by mouth to ear, they are indistinguishable. If one is untrue, the other is untrue.
But they now, written okay. somewhere. They written
that's,
somewhere.
Okay, that's the next statement. Let me get to the next point. Okay. Now, the next point is they are not an Arabian version. The fact is that the Quran and the Hadith did not initially were not initially written down in Arabia. Neither the Quran was not initially written in Arabia, and the Hadith were not originally written in Arabia. They both found writing about 100 years after, 100 years to 200 years after Muhammad's death, and both found their way to writing in Persia. They are Persian. All of them are Persian documents. The Quran, in terms of its original written version, was written in Persia, outside of today's Baghdad. The same thing is true with Tabari's compilation of hadith, and the same thing is true with Ishaq's compilation of hadith. So this idea of you don't have an Arabian version, there are no Arabian versions. The Quran...
Is there a Persian version then?
No, as it relates to Tabari's Tariq and Ishaq's Sirah, we do not actually have a early copy of, in fact, we don't have Ishaq's original. The only reason that we can put together the Sirah today is Hisham, about 50 to 100 years later, did a redaction of the Sirah, removing anything that could be considered detrimental to Muhammad, detrimental to the leaders of Islam at the time from the area outside of Baghdad. And then Tabari, because Tabari covers so much of what Ishaq originally wrote, and he has Ishaq in as a conveyor of the hadith. And if we put the two together, that's how we end up having these things. But no, the oldest version of it is the oldest extant version of these documents dates probably to the 9th century, something in that period of time. And there's a problem, really, Nick, with everything related to Islam. And that is that Muslims can't and won't.
Oh, these computers.
Well, they can't and won't publish old versions of anything. You know, the oldest versions of the Quran were found in Yemen, in the rafters of a mosque, and they had the world's leading, and because they couldn't themselves, paleographer. I go through, photograph all of it, compile it all, put it together as a document to study until such time as the German who was responsible for this, who is the leader in the world at what he does, he determined the evidence shows that there is very little correlation between the oldest Quran, and it dates to about 250 years after Muhammad's death, and it's the oldest extant Quran in the world, and there's various of them, that it's hugely different than the Quran today. Hugely different. And of course, Muslims want you to believe that the Quran is exactly word for word, precisely as Allah gave it to Muhammad. Well, what the oldest fragments say is that's not even remotely accurate. So what did they do? They fired the guy and they took all of his data that he had published and took it off the internet. So the very thing that these Muslims are saying that my citations of Tabari and Ishaq are not, the thing that they're calling for does not exist. Anytime there's an old document from Islam's past that provides a earlier witness to what was said and done, it's so much harsher. And it's so inconsistent with what Muslims have sanitized their religion into being that they forbid it from being published. And so that's just the bottom line. Now, as for what I quote it in English. My primary language is English. I wrote Prophet of Doom in English. And the translations that I used were all Islamic translations in the sense of the scholars who provided the translations were all Islamic scholars who who had spent their lives skilled in this very early form of Arabic, and so
the ones who are looking at the old
yeah, well, they don't exist. I mean, there are no old versions. Now, that's just the bottom line.
Did they destroy them all then?
Yes. Yeah, in fact, what the hadith actually says is that because the Quran versions, as they first were written down, and this would have been, they were first written down about 100 years after Muhammad's death, which that's a long time to pass on something via hearsay, that they became so divergent, that they were so incompatible with one another over that period of time, that what they did is created a blended version, and then they destroyed everything except their blended version. It's like the Vulgate, which is the Latin translation that was used by the Roman Catholic Church of the so-called Christian New Testament. What had happened is that from Greek into Old Latin, there were so many variants of the text that the Roman Catholic Church realized that with all these variants, they had no credibility.
Where can I find the proof of
and prophet of, yeah and prophet of and prophet of doom in the source material appendix, which is the follows the, it's the immediately after the 25th chapter of the book. So in Prophet of Doom, there's a source material appendix. It's available online. It's in its entirety. If you read that, it provides all of the information that is known to us regarding the hadith that says that the that the, from the Islam's own early records that there were so many variants that they were destroyed and compiled into one universal version. As it turns out, that wasn't even true, but that's what they claim. And then you'll also read about, I think his name is Gurin or Gerd, the German that was assigned to investigate the oldest documents, which are those found in Yemen. And you'll find the history of what he did and found. What you will find... Sure, Nick. What you'll find is that everything that the defenders of Islam are telling you is the opposite of what is true. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Well, welcome back to Shattering Myths. The next question that was posed by the USA Today mentioned James Clapper, now the person composing this roundtable, heading the roundtable, probably had not done the investigation into James Clapper to know his complicity in the Mumbai bombings and the decision that he had made relative to David Headley to employ him as part of the U.S. government to spy on the Pakistani ISI and in their perpetration of the Mumbai terrorist attack, and that he used a convicted heroin smuggler to perpetrate a terrorist attack and never came clean on doing so. Anyway, the question is, James Clapper, the National Director of National Intelligence, said Snowden's disclosure caused huge and grave damage to the United States. Do you agree? Weeby. No, of course not. No, not in any possible way. You know, I've asked people, do you genuinely believe there's a government has the government authorities are collecting information about you on the internet or on your use of the phone? And everyone says, of course, we know they are doing it. No one is surprised. It's just that when it's proven that they're doing it, we ought to be appalled. There's very little specificity in the slides that he made available describing PRISM and their surveillance program. There is far more specificity in the FISA court order, which is that federal intelligence, the secret court that rubber stamps these things, that is rather bothersome. Question. Did foreign governments, terrorist organizations, get information they didn't have already? Vinny. Ever since 1997 and 1998, so long before 2001, these terrorists, that's too bad they don't call them what they are, they're supposed to be intelligence officers, these fundamentalist Muslims, but they call them these terrorists, have known that we've been monitoring all of the communications all along, by the way. Of course they do, because we told them that we did. I mean, how many times has the American government blathered about, oh, there's all sorts of chatter on the internet which suggests this, that, and the other thing? And so we knew we were doing that because the government acknowledged doing that. And they knew we were doing it because we told them they were doing it, we were doing it. The terrorists have known that we're monitoring the communications all along, so they've already adjusted to the fact that we're doing that. So the fact that it's published in the U.S. news that we're doing that, it has no effect on them whatsoever. They have already adjusted to it. You know, when we raided Osama bin Laden's compound, that was the first thing that we learned, that he was not sending out in his communiques by cell phone, by satellite phone, or by email. That he had gone exclusively to a courier method with handwritten notes. Radek. Does this come up? This comes up every time there's a leak. In Tom's case, Tom was accused of literally the blood of soldiers would be on his hands because he created damage. That's what we did with Brady. Was it Manning, the young man that's now being tried for treason and espionage because he released documents that showed the malfeasance of the U.S. government. Blood of soldiers will be on his hands. Why in the hell are the soldiers over there anyway? When the NSA goes dark, soldiers die, they claim. Well, there's absolutely no correlation between the NSA's work and soldiers dying or soldiers living. And so this Raddick says, and that has nothing to do with Tom's disclosures at all, but was part of the fear-mongering that generally goes with why we should keep everything secret. Question. What did we learn from the document? The Verizon warrant issued by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISC, is Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that Snowden actually leaked. Drake. It's an extraordinary order. I mean, it's the first time we've seen publicly an actual secret surveillance court order. I don't really want to call it Foreign Intelligence Court anymore because I think it's just becoming a surveillance court, right? Oh, boy, that was brilliant. It's, you know, the name is Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, but what was the court order on? Domestic spying. That's brilliant. So they're already using a name for this that is inappropriate for what they're doing. Cover, if you will. So are we all foreigners now? Is every American a foreigner? By virtue of the order, every single foreign record that Verizon has turned over each and every day to the NSA must be by all foreigners that every American now, hundreds of millions of them, are foreigners. If this Foreign Intelligence Court was given the authority to impose the order. He said also, there was no probable cause. There was no indication of any kind of terrorism or counterterrorism or any investigation. Simply, give us the data.